Weaver's also written several books about opera, including Verdi, A Documentary Study, and The Golden Century of Italian Opera. It's 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. The Best of Fresh Air will return to its regular Sunday time, Sundays at noon, this Sunday, October 21st. And our guest this Sunday will be actress Nancy Marchand, who you might remember as the publisher, the newspaper publisher on the Lou Grant Show. She's spent most of her life in the theater and is currently in the Drama Guild production of Oliver Oliver. It's a minute after 4. And with me now on Fresh Air is Ralph Nader, who is given much of the credit for creating the consumer activist and public interest movements in America. His national campaign for safety in consumer products was launched in 1965 with the publication of his bestseller Unsafe at Any Speed, The Designs and Dangers of the American Automobile. This book criticized the auto industry for its emphasis on profit and style over safety. This book and Nader's subsequent congressional testimony was largely responsible for the passage of the National Traffic and Motor Vehicle Safety Act. He followed this groundbreaking work with exposés that led to the creation of the Natural Gas Pipeline Safety Act, the Federal Coal and Mine Health and Safety Act, the Occupational Health and Safety Act, and the Consumer Product Safety Act. Nader and his Nader's Raiders also investigated many regulatory agencies, including the Federal Trade Commission, the Food and Drug Administration, and the Environmental Protection Agency. He now oversees the work of four organizations that he founded, the Center for Study of Responsive Law, the Corporate Accountability Research Group, the Public Interest Research Group, and the Telecommunication Research and Action Center. Ralph Nader lives and works in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
At what point in your career and why did your emphasis start to shift from the safety of individual products to looking at regulations and legislation, examining regulatory agencies instead of manufacturers of products?
Well, it's the move from the symptom to the cause. You start out with the evidence at hand. It usually is a contaminated meat plant or an unsafe car. And people get interested in these areas because obviously they want safe products. And then you go to the companies who produce it, and then you see how they're able to get away with it. And then you see what the rule of law should be to curb their recklessness. And then once the law is passed, you got to make sure it's implemented in a fair way, an effective way, to fulfill its purposes of saving lives and reducing disease. And then you get into, well, maybe the consumers out there are going to have to organize to counteract the lobbies in Washington who are trying to weaken the implementation of the law. So you get deeper and deeper and deeper into the roots of the democratic process.
What point do you see the state of the art in consumer and public interest activism being now?
Well, it's well beyond the disclosure phase, the disclosure of abuses and corruption and so forth. That still goes on, but people want action. And it's very hard to get action with Ronald Reagan in the White House, who is diametrically opposed to the enforcement of laws designed to help consumers avoid harmful products and to help consumers in the marketplace so they don't get cheated. So that the stage of the consumer movement now is one of basically saying, well, we've lost the government. It doesn't really defend people anymore. It promotes big business. Therefore, we've got to go into the private citizen arena to try to organize even more thoroughly consumer groups so then they can recover their government.
Have you changed your tactics to suit the period, you know, the way in which you try to organize citizens?
Oh, yes. For example, it's now very important to get people directly involved, not simply to advocate things that people want but don't push themselves for. Because once you go after big business, you can beat them in the first stages in Washington, congressional hearings, legislation, courts. But in the meantime, they're reorganizing. They're beefing up their corporate lobbies, their trade associations in Washington are pouring money into the campaigns of legislators. So on the second stage, you got to have a lot of people out there organized. And, of course, the people really have the power in this country if they use it. No corporation can stand up against organized citizens.
How much do you think your effectiveness depends on who's in the White House?
Well, certainly in terms of enforcing the law. We can't enforce the law. It's got to be the president. It's got to be the Secretary of Transportation for auto safety standards, for example, or the Justice Department to go after corporate crime. And if the president basically is giving a go signal to corporations to do what they want, then the consumer movement is going to lose the support of the federal government. That's what's happened under Mr. Reagan. It's unfortunate that it isn't made into a campaign issue, because what's on people's minds, beside the arms race and jobs, are utility rates and safe food and clean drinking water and safe cars and products that don't fall apart right after you buy them and decent advertising. None of this is being incorporated into the political dialogue of the two candidates.
I know that you feel that some of the safeguards that have been built in and some of the regulations have been eroded under the Reagan administration. What have you found to be the most serious loss of ground from your perception in the past 4 years?
I think it's in the area of just scuttling these food and drug safety programs and meat and poultry inspection and auto safety programs, product safety commission. All these agencies have just been told, look the other way. You don't enforce the law, don't recall the products, don't set new standards. They haven't even done anything in the pesticide area, even though a major laboratory which developed the data for registering hundreds of pesticides was shown to be falsifying the data, which makes all these pesticide registrations not based in scientific fact. And the Reagan people have not done a thing there. I think the thing that I find difficult to understand about Mr. Reagan is why he doesn't want to go down in American history as a man who defended the people against the big boys, as a man who saved American lives on the highway instead of going out of his way to revoke a critical automatic crash protection standard in 1981 designed to keep people from going through windshields. The motivation of a person in the White House should be to rise above being a slave to the big, powerful interests and to defend the people. If you can't do it as president, whenever are you going to do it?
My guest is Ralph Nader, and we'll try to get to the phones in a little while for your questions and comments. In a way, one of the biggest consumer decisions we make is when we go to the voting booth, because we're kind of shopping for our congressional leaders and our president. The ways in which we get the information now about who we're voting for in the presidency is, of course, the newspapers and the news and radio broadcasts. But now we rely as well on televised debates. And whether we rely on it or not, there's a barrage of political advertising from both sides. What would you like to see? I mean, would you like to see debates be, compulsory for candidates? And what do you think of political advertising? Do you think that that's useful for we consumers who are shopping for our elected officials?
Well, I think political advertising on TV ought to be prohibited. It can never do anything than try to manipulate people's emotions. The 1 minute ad should be prohibited. I mean, if you go 5 minutes to 30 minutes, you got a chance to communicate something other than Hollywood type blimps on the screen. I must say that a major advertising executive has come out for that too, Mr. O'Toole, who runs a big advertising agency in New York. He wants to ban these 1 minute ads. I think we ought to have more debates. I don't know whether it should be required or not as a part of the election laws. That's pretty hard to enforce. But I think the public should have a higher demand level so that they don't just let two men decide how many debates they have. Mondale wanted six, Reagan wanted one, and they settled on two.
Well, you mentioned the length of time. It seems to me you can actually get a lot said in a minute if you care to say it, and you can use a 30-minute promotional advertisement for just sheer promotional fluff. Do you really think it's a question of time that's the problem with political advertising?
Yes, because they want to influence as many people as possible, and they've persuaded themselves that they do it with fluff and emotion and symbols, showing Mr. Reagan near flags and bands and amber waves of grain and all the rest of it, than by communicating something in a minute.
But haven't you seen 30-minute programs by both parties that are as promotional and content-free as some of the 60-second spots are?
Yes, but all right, ban all political advertisements. I think that's a denigration of democracy, these ads. I think it's the least that can happen is for radio and TV to to give free time to the candidates, so at least they don't have to indenture themselves to the money bags in order to pay for it. That's what they do in Great Britain. The parties get a certain amount of free time on TV and radio.
How much do you know?
Oh, several hours for an 8-week campaign.
I don't know if this is still functioning or not, but you used to have a group called Congress Watch, which would rate congressmen according to how they voted on legislation that you targeted as being important. How useful was that for your means, which was to influence voters to vote for the congressional candidates that you thought would be most in the public interest? Did people find out about those voting records? Did you find it to be a useful tool?
It was a curb on the members of Congress. They didn't like those voting records being disclosed. You see, if you write your member of Congress, you say, let me have your voting record for 1984 and the major categories of defense, environment, Social Security, you won't get it. You'll get a letter back saying, well, what particular votes are you interested in? They don't like to reveal it all. They figure it's a no-win game. So our voting record, the public citizen voting record, has had a salutary influence in that way. Also, it gets out in the field. Newspapers use it in the congressional districts. Unfortunately, more and more votes are taken in Congress on the floor as a voice vote. So you can't, there's no recording of who voted for or against or who wasn't there.
Some congressmen say that it's difficult to just look at a voting record and understand it because you might vote down a bill. And it's actually because you wanted to see a stronger version of it instead, and that stronger version never got passed, but it's not that you're against the issue, you're against the way it was watered down, or that you were forced to vote for a bill as a favor in order to ensure passage of a bill that you thought was even more important, because there's a lot of agreements that are, and arrangements that are made in Congress.
Well, that's why we also have some key amendments as votes. So we'll have like the final vote on a bill plus three key amendments, say, to the Superfund bill, which occurred just a few days ago. There were three key amendments, and most people voted for the Superfund bill, but a lot of them voted against the strengthening amendments.
Would you ever consider running for public office?
No. By the way, when I mentioned banning political ads, I didn't mean banning the candidates coming on and speaking themselves. That's what I would like to see encouraged. If they want to buy a minute or 2 minutes and they want to come and speak, that's one thing. But not to have some Madison Avenue circus team try to do everything they can to mislead people without that candidate ever appearing on there.
But I wonder if it isn't all the same because someone from Madison Avenue could be writing the copy and finding the makeup artist and choosing the camera.
Well, let him, but at least the words are attributed to him. Right now you see on TV, for example, some baritone voice going after Mondale for his alleged tax, for his tax increase proposal. Now, Mondale said that he would take the revenues from the upper income people by closing corporate loopholes to try to deal with the deficit. Reagan said he's not going to increase taxes, but his people right now are preparing a comprehensive tax bill for next year, which they'll call reform, but which will actually increase taxes. Both candidates are going to have to increase taxes, whoever wins. But the baritone voice on the Reagan ad against Mondale misleads the public in how he describes the Mondale tax package. And he gets away with it because nobody knows the baritone voice belongs to. But if Mr. Reagan came on TV and he had to say that, he'd be held accountable for that mistake or that falsification.
Let's get back to the question about why you wouldn't run for Congress or for any elected office.
Well, why should I? The office of citizenship, full-time, is the most important in a democracy because most social movements, if not all, start with citizens. Then government responds or corporations respond. The women's right to vote movement, civil rights, environment, the populist progressive movement, the turn of the century of the farmers, the labor movement, all started with people. So that the root of a democracy is the activity of the people, and the branches are only as good as the root, and I prefer to work at the root.
Do you ever think about the kind of compromises you'd have to make if you were running for office? Because usually to get in, you have to financing behind you.
Oh, yes. That's another. The course required in terms of raising money from private interest groups, all of which want their quid pro quo, is demeaning. It's corrupting. Also, politicians can't talk straight to people. invariably, whoever they are, liberals, conservatives, they all they do is flatter the people. They can't talk straight to people. Like Reagan, that's what he's doing. I love America. You're all great. You're what's made this country great. And of course, that papers over real problems. We want to get people to address themselves to problems that they see are serious, not to have a kind of a permanent cheerleader give them a parade with flags. Waving flags doesn't clean up toxic waste dumps.
My guest is Ralph Nader, and we'll try to get to the telephones in a few minutes for your questions and comments. You've been one of the greatest advocates of and also one of the greatest users of the Freedom of Information Act. What are some of the ways you've used that act to get access to information that you thought had a great effect on the direction of our country?
Well, we got the meat and poultry inspection plants, which were released in newspapers around the country. The dirty nature of these plants created an uproar and led to the passage of the Meat and Poultry Health Acts in 1967 and 68. We did the same thing with the nursing home inspection reports. We're getting all kinds of information now about toxics. It's just all over. I mean, most of the abuses in the last 15 years have some way been uncovered because of the Freedom of Information Act or the fear of it by government employees, leading to their voluntary relinquishment of the information.
Perhaps the most common criticism that's been leveled against you since you've gotten your national reputation is that in your zeal to put in regulatory safeguards, you advocate over-regulation that really cripples large and small businesses and sets up impossible bureaucracies that everyone who operates a business has to navigate through, making their life very unnecessarily difficult. How do you respond to that criticism?
Where are these impossible bureaucracies? The Auto Safety Agency, where is the overregulation? The Auto Safety Agency hasn't issued a single mandatory standard, with one exception, the rear light on your back window, that's stuck since 1970. Yet the auto companies say overregulation. Now, this is just company propaganda because they can't contend on the merits. They have to build some sort of mythical, oppressive structure. The fact is that most governments are soft on corporate fraud, corporate negligence, corporate crime. And all we can try to do is once in a while get them to prosecute these culprits or get these companies pollution toilet trained or get them to obey safety laws so people don't die or get injured because of dangerous products like drugs, automobiles, flammable fabrics.
When a corporation or a regulatory agency knows that you or someone from one of your affiliate groups is going to be investigating them, do you find that there is any methods that are used to try to prevent you from finding out more about them? Has that ever happened?
Yeah, they try to get the agency to keep material that the company gave to the agency secret. That's one. And they try to go up on Capitol Hill and counteract us. And they pour money into campaigns like the auto dealers and the used car rule. Then they try to meet with editorial writers and get editorials on their side. And sometimes they play pretty fast and loose with the facts.
You've been traveling around the country a lot, talking to college students, which is something that I think you've done for years. What are some of the things you tell them now when you try to activate college students?
Tell them to learn the art of reading and thinking. Very basic. A lot of the students who say they're for Reagan don't know a thing about what Reagan's government has done. You ask them, they say, well, he makes me feel better, and he's strong leader, things like that. You say, well, do you know that he's cut educational aid, and if he was allowed to get away with it, a million of you in college wouldn't be there now because financial aid would have been cut to the bone? Oh, I didn't know that. I said, do you know he hasn't issued a single safety standard under the Clean Drinking Water Act? 140 million Americans are drinking water that doesn't meet standards? Oh, I didn't know that. So that students have been so clued to vocational training in college, you know, just accounting and marketing courses, business administration courses. They forgot about the literature and the social sciences and broadening their mind and reading, digging into the fact. So they set themselves up for political candidates to win their favor like a soap company does on TV.
Well, one of the problems that I know a lot of college students are going through now is that as much as they might enjoy taking a liberal arts type program, that they know the job market is so competitive that they feel pressured to choose an area that will definitely, or at least most likely, lead to a decent paying job after school. Is that cutting down your effectiveness in trying to convince people to spend some of their professional time as activists?
Well, it cuts down their receptivity to their own significance in life. They look at themselves pretty much as just a employee cog in some big corporate wheel instead of being movers and shakers and leaders themselves. But things could be turned around. We're encouraging students now, 2 hours before the October 21st debate between Reagan and Mondale, to have teach-ins at their universities and colleges, have a pro-Mondale, pro-Reagan person, have questions from the audience, unlike the real debate, or so-called debate between Mondale and Reagan, where questions are not allowed from the audience, and then have the community media cover these sessions in an auditorium, and after 2 hours, the lights go off, and on the big screen comes Reagan and Mondale, and they can all watch the exchange together. So there are about over 100 of those now already underway. So, I mean, students, they give themselves a chance. They're very receptive to factual disclosures and factual discussions.
Do you think of that you were an activist when you were in college?
I was, but in the 50s, an activist was pretty modest by definition compared to the 60s and 70s. More of a dissenter. There wasn't much activity at all in any organized sense among students.
What were you dissenting?
Well, for example, they would be spraying the trees in the spring with DDT hoses. And it would get on students' faces, and they'd wipe out the DDT. And at the time, they thought, well, DDT only kills insects, you know. It doesn't affect humans. And next morning, I'd see, early in the morning, walking through the campus, I'd see a lot of dead birds. And so I tried to get the college paper or professors to see whether there's a connection between DDT and the birds dying. And they all said, well, you know, the experts would have told us if there was. That sort of thing. There was never any organized movement the way there are now, public interest research groups funded by students with their own scientists on staff, their own lawyers. It's much, much more advanced now.
Were you considered a kook for doubting the experts?
I don't think it went that far, but it was considered kind of a maverick, yeah.
You chose as your first major area of investigation the automobile industry.
Actually, it was American Indian plight, the plight of the American Indian.
Oh, was that when you were still in school? Or?
Yeah, at the law school.
Well, what were you looking at there?
Well, I went to some reservations out west and saw how miserable their living standards were and wrote a very long article, which was very widely distributed in this country, called American Indians, People Without a Future.
And after that, you chose the auto industry?
Yes.
Why did you focus in on the safety of automobiles?
Well, I was interested in personal injury law at Harvard Law School and the responsibility of manufacturers in producing safe products. And, of course, what's the big product? Automobiles. So I did a research paper on it as part of a medical legal seminar and then tried to get people interested in doing something about it. And when nobody became interested in Massachusetts, Connecticut legislatures, I decided to take it up full time.
Had you or anyone close to you been in a car accident before that?
No, but I've seen plenty of them because I hitchhiked tens of thousands of miles around the country and I saw more than my share of gory crashes.
I've read that after Unsafe at Any Speed was published that there were detectives hired from car companies to follow you.
And, yeah, GM hired a detective firm and was exposed and the president GM was called down to the Senate at a widely publicized hearing and apologized.
Were you aware of it at the time?
I became aware of it.
Well, what did you notice that
well,
made you realize
you know,
that you were being trailed?
Yeah, you'd see them outside hotels and at airports. And one time I went to a bank and I was trailed right into the bank. And they were caught because they trailed me down to the Senate and the Senate guard caught them. That's how it all unraveled. Yeah, GM had done this to about 23 other people using the same detective firm. They had a practice that when, like, a black leader in Harlem criticized them for discrimination in employment, they hired a detective firm to look into them.
Do you think that cars are safer now than they were in 1965 when Unsafe at Any Speed was prevalent?
Oh, yes. They're more crash-worthy. 10,000 people lives are saved a year at least, 100,000 injuries prevented. Simple things like padded dash panels, collapsible steering columns, shoulder belts, you know, three-point belts, stronger door latches, more elastic windshields, head restraints, stronger side structures. But it could have been much better. We should now have standard equipment, airbags. Just like brakes stop cars, airbags stop people from going through cars. That would have been wonderful. The president of GM wanted it in 1970, but before GM put them in all their cars, he retired, and his successors reversed his policy and established a fight Washington all the way policy instead. So there are thousands and thousands of Americans who have been killed, and many of them disabled for life because of that opposition by GM, which the other companies followed.
I understand that you don't own a car. Does that have anything to do with safety?
No, I don't need a car. I don't live in the suburbs, and there's good downtown transportation, and I don't like to spend time worrying about a car, driving a car in traffic, finding a place to park.
Are there cars that you won't drive in because of their safety record?
Yeah, the small cars, like the Volkswagen Beetle, and of course the old Corvair.
Does it ever seem to you that, cars are made out of more easily crushed material than they used to be?
Well, that's not necessarily bad. That can actually absorb the collision force. So by the time it reaches you, it's declined in what they call G levels.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Ralph Nader, if you're just joining us. You've also done a lot of food research. And in reading about you, I also learned how many teaspoons of sugar are in a can of Coca-Cola, which really surprised me. Now, would you want to tell what the answer to that question is?
9.2 teaspoons of sugar in your can of regular Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola.
Now, how did you find that out? Did you ask the manufacturers?
No, it's available. Anybody wants to check with the Food and Drug Administration? Actually, the Center for Science and the Public Interest in Washington, a citizen group, brought all that together.
Has the research that you've done in food changed the way you eat?
Well, my mother always got children to have a good diet. So I didn't grow up eating hot dogs and then suddenly stopped eating hot dogs. We never ate hot dogs. So we have a pretty good diet from the beginning. Sometimes things you do find out about do change certain items of food that you would ordinarily eat. You find that yellow dye number 5 is under suspicion, and if you're eating something with yellow dye number 5, you might not want to.
Were your parents socially, politically active?
They were always active local citizens, yeah, in their local community. But they always talked about our citizen duties at dinner table. The emphasis was on duties. You know, the phrase was, if you love your country, you work to make your country more lovable. You don't wave a flag and utter a slogan.
So they weren't upset that you weren't going to work for law firm that could pay you a high salary, that instead you were going to become a consumer activist.
Oh, no.
When you go shopping for something, do people recognize you and know who you are?
Yes.
Is that embarrassing? Or do people try to give you discounts or show off how terrific and safe their merchandise is?
Well, sometimes cab drivers want to transport me free, which is a nice feeling. I always pay, but it's nice to see them, that they've recognized some of the things we've done. In supermarkets, people, you know, they just chat amiably. And I kid them when they're putting their hands on a Wonder Bread or a bunch of hot dogs.
Do you use any credit cards?
No. I think that just increases prices. It also increases impulse buying. It also sets up a private file, which can be abused by companies invading people's privacy.
Let's invite our listeners, if they have any questions or comments. My guest is Ralph Nader. And if you have any questions, our number is 923-2774 at area code 215. That's 923-2774. You're an employer because you oversee about 4 different groups now, and one of the groups has about 171 or something different offshoots within it. How do you think you'd react if your workers tried to unionize or, you know, something like that, which is a kind of classic situation for employers?
I'd say, why are they demeaning themselves? Because they're basically working for themselves, and we're supporting them. Because none of them work for anything they don't believe in. Nobody is expected to work for anything you don't believe in. They don't punch in, punch out. They have to meet a certain standard of production because the people who send us money, $15 a year, are entitled to performance. So I think a belief organization like a citizen group, that's a nonprofit group, cannot have that kind of division between the employees and the so-called management. As a matter of fact, the management in these groups not only work harder, but they often have to do a lot of the trudgery and the work and raise the funds for these people.
Well, I've heard from a growing number of people who work in nonprofit organizations, both political and arts nonprofit organizations, a growing amount of dissatisfaction and feeling that in order to work in a nonprofit organization now, you're expected to make so much self-sacrifice, and that there's a fine line between voluntarily making self-sacrifice and being exploited by that organization in the name of the public good.
Well, those are larger. Ours are very small. I mean, none of our groups have more than 10 or 11 people in them, so keep it really very personal. And every leader of that group works harder than everyone else, longer hours than everyone else, is responsible for the mistakes, and has to raise the funds. It isn't your normal hierarchical employment situation at all. The people who have responsibility in our organizations are the people who've worked the hardest, the longest. That's how you rise. So someone who comes in 2 months on the job, they expect to have the same, community role as someone who's been there 10 years. They just don't get it that way, not unless they're, absolute geniuses. They have to learn. They don't understand that being an active citizen requires skills, just like being a good doctor, and you're not a chief surgeon overnight when you get out of medical school.
So it's never been a problem for you to figure out where that line is between willing sacrifice and unwilling exploitation?
No, because, see, they're working for something they believe in. That's the key. I mean, they're not there if they don't want to advance nutrition or get safer cars. I mean, that's the whole difference right there. Whereas people working in the marketplace area, they have to follow orders. A lot of times they have to do things they don't want to do or don't believe in doing.
Have you ever had any employees who felt at some point they had to stop working for what they believe in because what they believe in just paid so poorly that they couldn't have a family and work for what they believe in?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Well, it's a kind of classic dilemma for people.
It is, because you want to try to get the most for people's contributions. And so instead of paying someone $40,000, you pay three people $14,000, and you get much more work. If you did pay someone $40,000, the first thing someone, they'd write about it is, look at those high salaries and, that sort of thing. So we're very frugal, and I think we keep a pretty high standard of productivity. The people in our organizations don't really, massively overwork. I mean, it's up to them, but they may work 50, 55 hours a week. That's not heavy stuff. Not compared to the directors of the groups who may work 60, 70 hours a week.
How many hours a week do you think you work?
Over 70.
What do you do for pleasure when you're not working?
Sleep.
Is that because it's a lot of fun or because that's all there's time for?
That's all there's time for.
Okay, why don't we take a couple of phone calls? Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air, and you should put on your headphones. So. Hi, go ahead.
I'd like Mr. Nader to comment on the fact that, to my understanding, the telephone company's liability in providing their service is limited to the cost of the service. That is, if they cut you off or interfere with the operation of your business by not providing telephone service, their only liability is the cost of the service, whereas a guy on the corner making a hamburger, should you get poisoned, his liability is much more than the cost of that hamburger. Would you comment on that?
Well, you're absolutely right, and I don't think there's going to be any change because, for example, if they don't put you in the yellow pages and you lose $1 million business, it's very hard to get them for $1 million. That's called consequential damages. And you'd have to pass a law to give people the right to recover that way. The the phone companies are pretty immunized. They figure they could be, you know, they could be driven to the brink of bankruptcy if they have to handle all those kinds of claims. You know, if I had this phone service, I would have made a big sale. And by the time I got the phone service, the customer had gone to Japan. And no, you can't get into those sort of things.
Thank you for your call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air, and we're very short on time, so I'll ask you to keep it brief. Go ahead.
The show about the so-called media monopoly. It's something Ralph spoke about at the National Press Club, and you had a show on yesterday. It seems the media can distort facts in a major way. An example in Philadelphia would be the Mayor Good, Frank Rizzo election. The media said, well, Mayor Good was way ahead, it would be no contest. Yet, even though I'm a good supporter, it was a very close election, and to me, the public was seriously misled, and I can almost see it happening again in the Mondale-Reagan election. Could you comment on that?
Well, the evidence supporting your claim goes like this. A lot of people are going to vote for Mondale who don't have phones or who don't respond to polls. Therefore, the polls exaggerate in favor of Reagan. A lot of people who say they're not going to vote for Ferraro, once they get in that booth, women, for example, will say, well, I'll show the old man. I'll show the husband. I'll vote for Ferraro. We'll see what happens.
Thank you very much for your call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air, and I'll ask you to keep it brief.
Well, I'll do it very fast. It's difficult to change once you have learned to use a certain group of pesticides. There's a lot of time and money spent in learning to do this. What I want to know is, why this isn't tested before it even hits the market? I mean, it isn't the farmer who wants to ruin his land or ruin the water that he uses on the crop. Do you understand what I'm saying?
What was your question?
My question was, first of all, that which I would like to know which pesticides are considered to be dangerous that were not reported. For the most part, growers get together and they learn which pesticides are safe and they use them.
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, you're supposed to rely on the Environmental Protection Agency's registration process, and then they're supposed to not be registering pesticides that are hazardous. The problem is that often they don't do the adequate testing, or the companies falsify the tests, or, as has been shown in a criminal conviction, the laboratory contracted by these chemical companies falsified the tests on the basis of which many pesticides were registered. So they all have to be looked at again. There are pesticides that are licensed. Chlordane is one. It's often used to control termites. I would never have chlordane in any house that I was in. I'd rather live with termites than chlordane. Chlordane is extremely bad for people. And yet,
that was the substance in Agent Orange, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that's what the companies say, that there's nothing else that can control termites other than, you know, tearing out the pillars and rebuilding the whole thing. Well, some people think there are other ways to control termites, try to locate the source of moisture. But when it comes down to certain pests that are slightly a nuisance, but they don't communicate any disease, or being exposed to fumes from a lethal pesticide, scratch the latter.
Thanks for your call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air, and you just have a few seconds for your question.
The question is, has Mr. Nader or any of his groups investigated the situation in education? I would love to see his touch applied to an area where there is just so much nonsense about it.
Unfortunately not. We wish we had the resources to do that. We have exposed the multiple choice standardized testing industry, and we have put out a teacher's kit for consumer education called To Buy or Not to Buy for junior high school and high school students to get them to develop their citizen skills, which they often don't do, or their consumer skills. But we have not gone into more of the conventional educational issues.
Okay, thanks for your call. I know you have to leave in just about a minute. I regret that you won't be able to stay with us longer. So before you leave, I'd like to ask you what areas you're targeting for the next few months or the next year.
Well, we're doing a voter education program to get the issues before the public, before the November 6th election. We just beseech people who are going to decide who they're going to vote for to take a few hours of their time, 3-4 hours, and read the records of the candidates, not what they say. Mr. Reagan says the opposite of what he does. Mr. Mondale has never been a president, of course, so you rely on his Senate record, and he now is promising certain things. I would just look at what they have done. That's what you don't see on those television ads.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for being with us this afternoon.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
And I've been speaking with public interest activist and consumer activist Ralph Nader, and he has to leave us now. My regrets to those of you who are hanging on the telephone who won't be able to speak with him this afternoon. Thank you, those of you who called with your questions and comments. It's 20 minutes to 5 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air. You tune to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. In just a few minutes, we'll hear National Public Radio Tom Shales reviewing the new movie The Razor's Edge, which stars Bill Murray in his first serious role. So that's coming up in just a few minutes on Fresh Air. Right now, we're going to hear a duet between singer Sheila Jordan and bass player Harvey Swartz. This is Let's Face the Music and Dance.
There may be trouble ahead.